Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akil, and if you're interested in open source, systems thinking, distributed systems, and much, much more, this episode is for you. Joining me today is William Rizzo. What a fantastic guy. He's a lead architect over at SUSE, and we had a blast of a conversation. I'll put all his socials in the description below. Check him out. And with that being said, enjoy the episode.
Beyond Coding.
Lately, I've been struggling with that because I like audiobooks. I like listening to stuff.
Yep.
That is my kind of preferred medium. Also to learn, I figured out. But then it's really hard because it is audio, I can do other stuff. So I do them. And then sometimes I feel like the information doesn't process as much as if I would sit down and read.
Absolutely.
So I'm trying to figure out if I need to like take notes or something. Like I feel like I need to up my note taking game during listening to audiobooks, because otherwise it just vanishes.
Yeah. I had the same problem, and I tried a kind of note taking technique that didn't work that well. When they were mentioning something, or I would hear something that is worth to look into, I would open a tab on my browser and I would just open a page and put it there and then continue the work there.
I've also done that.
It doesn't work, no. Right? Absolutely doesn't work. It's like you have like 1900 tabs open and you don't know where the music is coming from.
No, you don't want to close them either.
Right.
And you end up just a mess.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do take my notes and sometimes also the old way, you know, with a pen.
And, interesting.
Yeah, and that works, but it absolutely. I also like prefer to listen to things.
Interesting. Do you listen to a lot of audiobooks then as well?
I do while I'm driving with a car, maybe a long trip. Then I like to listen to an audiobook, but they wouldn't be necessarily technical.
Yeah.
But I found myself buying technical books, like physical books.
Yeah.
Podcast and sometimes videos as well on YouTube, but just let it run and I'm listening in the headset, and then maybe I pause what I'm doing and I go back to the video if I listen to something that if I hear something that is really worth checking out. But other than that, that's it.
Yeah, I can imagine. I've been listening to, it's called The Engineering Manager's Path. It's by Camille Fournier. And she's not reading the book, which I also thought like maybe that's a bit odd. I expected the author to also read the book or like do the voiceover for the audiobook, but it's not her. But regardless, I feel like the essence of the content is really good. But then I'm just like, if I were to say what she said so far, and I've listened to a few hours, it'd be really small because I feel like I recollect a small bit of it. So I'm struggling with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to listen to more technical oriented books. It's just hard.
It is.
I need to figure out how to retain that info.
It is. I think so. I think I have the same problem to retain an information when I just hear
it.
But if I'm reading it, somehow I'm giving it a shape in my head.
Exactly.
So I can call that address in memory when I need it.
That's a good one. I don't know if it has to do with focus, because I do like audio as a medium also because I can do other stuff. I mean, you mentioned driving. I don't really drive, but I don't even know what I do sometimes. I clean or I cook, and I like to listen to stuff. But yeah, maybe it's because of that multi-processing that it doesn't retain as much as when I sit down and just read, because then I'm only doing that. I can't really do anything else.
Yeah, I think, I think that we do work a lot with visualization when we are learning something.
Mm.
There is this Nobel Prize that mentioned that like the work with System 1 and System 2. We have our System 1, which is the system in our brain that we engage to do mundane things where it doesn't require our attention.
Yeah.
Whereas System 2 is the one that we really need to spend energies in, and we can't engage in a two type of System 2 activities.
Mm.
We can only do a one System 2 activity and one System 1 activity, and the System 1 activity can affect the System 2 or can end up not being done well. The example is like you're driving and, you know, maybe you're driving in the city and you're having an argument with the person sitting beside you. You are very, very likely to have an accident because System 2 is engaged, and the activity that you have going on is also a System 2 type of activity because it's getting a lot of energy, a lot of processing in your head.
Yeah.
So I think that you wouldn't be able to learn anything if you're doing the learning part, or maybe audio,
yeah,
and you're also cleaning up. You're also, I don't know, sorting out things on your computer, because those are kind of two system, two activities.
Yeah, they interfere.
Yeah, they do interfere. So.
Interesting. I've never heard that theory about the system two and the system one. But I think
the book is Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow.
Ah, okay. So that's on my list to listen to as an audiobook.
Oh, there you go.
We have the book over there behind us.
I really recommend it. It's a good book.
I'll put that on my list. I'll take that next.
Yeah.
Interesting. But I do feel like it's recognizable, but also like when I'm picking up something new, I feel like that is system two. Like I'm really engaged and I feel like time slows down.
Right.
Like even both ways, sometimes it slows down and sometimes it even goes faster. I don't quite recognize when what happens, but then when I've done that over and over and over again, then I'm like, okay, now that I've done this, it's kind of more so autopilot. And then I feel like I can put an audiobook on and like do stuff at the same time. Yeah, but maybe it's still system two then. That's my pitfall.
Yeah, maybe. I think that I think there are activities that can go from one system to another when they become your habit, let's call it a habit. They can go end off to the system one.
Yeah.
However, you might have the impression like you're driving and you just all of a sudden you become a good driver, you know, you're confident and comfortable. Just start picking up your phone, just sending out messages on your phone while you're driving. And it doesn't mean that you are good at driving so you can pick up the phone. It just means that you are getting off the focus and now the focus is shifting on something else that unfortunately can become dangerous. So.
Yeah, interesting. And it also, I feel like it snowballs, right? Because probably I don't drive, so I've never done this. But I feel like some people would start out and they would be like, I'm just going to check what notification that was.
Yeah.
And then they do it again and they're like, oh, I'll just send a fast reply.
Yeah.
And then the next thing, they're like browsing Reddit and driving at the same time. Like it escalates.
Right.
And in their mind, they probably don't see the graduality of how it escalates. And you find yourself at a point where you're just looking at your phone, you're not really driving anymore.
Right.
Which is very dangerous.
It is. And driving on the motorbike, you notice that a lot.
Mm.
So sometimes I always look at the wheels of a car, not necessarily at the car, to see what is happening with that car. And you see this car maybe like waving from left to right, not a lot, a little bit, which is still, for most people, is still not a problem.
Yeah.
But for a biker is very vulnerable, right, to whatever happens in the road. So I'm double careful.
Yeah.
And when I pass a car like that, I notice that they are busy with their phone.
Yeah.
And that is what you don't notice. You the attention that you put in the phone extends over in time. It extends the more you do it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I hope some people realize that they're having their eyes on the phone for something like 30 seconds and they're not looking at the road anymore. And 30 seconds, there are a lot of things that can happen on the road.
So. That's a long time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
If you see them wobbly, I mean, especially on a motorbike, like I can imagine that's pretty scary.
Yeah, it gets scary because that person can maybe get upset or something, shift the attention and, things go wrong.
So. Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, when you're picking up a new topic, and I assume you do that pretty often because it's just the field we're in. Sometimes we have to pick up a new topic. Do you really like lay down everything and focus on the specific topic or what is your process?
Sometimes I do. I like I have built up a process on my own, kind of a routine.
Okay.
It's like putting everything into little boxes, mental boxes, kind of. Let's say I need to learn something work-wise or I need to learn something and I just create my little space and I'll say, okay, from this time until this time, I'm going to do that and I'm going to put away everything.
Yeah.
It doesn't always go the way you plan it, but that is the idea. I listened at a tech head once.
Yeah.
And there was this man talking about how successful inventors put things into physical or mental boxes to pick up where they left. And I tried it. It works. Mm. I should use more physical boxes than mental boxes, maybe. But with digital work, it's difficult to do so. But I try to do that. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
I had a friend of my own on Chiatsa Moguti, and she's a product manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, like the idea of managing a backlog and like prioritizing and figuring out what goes first and where the value is, it's like, how do you do that? And she's like, I put everything in boxes. That's the first thing she said. I put everything in mental boxes with regards to categories. And then we align, okay, what goes first from which bucket? Do we do a full bucket at once or do we not do that? But she categorizes everything in buckets. And when she laid that out, I was like, okay, categorization. That makes a lot of sense. And I don't think I do that consciously, but definitely subconsciously. I'm like, okay, this goes there, that goes there.
We do that.
Yeah, for it to make sense.
Yeah, we do that. We need to relate to previous knowledge, to that we have previous experiences. We always do that. We constantly do that. And when we stop doing it, we evolve slower into that learning that we want to do, or into that task that we want to do. We move slower. But if we can do it more consciously, and that's the box, right? That's the categorization. Yeah, you're winning.
Yeah, I can imagine. But then the problem is, I feel like I've heard this before as well of a friend, Diana Montalion, and she says people are really good at linear thinking. Like if A happens, then B, like those subsequent order of events, we're really good at that.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you're talking about a system, any system, even a distributed system, it's harder because if A happens and all of a sudden you get Z and you're like, how the hell did we go from A to Z? Like, because B is supposed to be next.
Yeah.
And then that's where the complexity kicks in and we're not really good at that yet.
Right. Right. Yeah. The complexity, there are many definitions of, it's funny. I just had a talk at a meetup group and I asked what is the definition of a complex system.
Mm.
And nobody dared to answer.
No, that's a hard one.
No, it's beautiful. Yeah. And there is no universal accepted definition of what a complex system is.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit of also a cheeky question because,
you know
that there isn't. but that is the complex system. If you think about, okay, represent in 2D and is the in the simplest form as you can, a complex system. The first thing that 90% of people are going to do, they're going to do some sort of web of points that connect to many other points.
Yeah.
And that is where what you just said, right? I mean, you don't go from A to B. You might go from A to T, Z, A, E, and B is the last item, but there isn't a last item because everything is connected. That is complexity. That is how we don't think.
Yeah.
But that is how we live, how we exist. Our brain works like that, right?
Exactly.
So
that's sometimes also what we build.
Right.
Maybe not consciously.
Absolutely.
But like that is the output sometimes of what we build, or like a combination of efforts.
Right.
Can create that.
Right. Kubernetes. We're working with that. We hate ourselves that much to build a complex system to live in. So
is that why you think like a lot of people, like Kubernetes is very powerful? I'm assuming that's where the power also comes from, but also where the complexity comes from, with people picking it up for the first time, for example.
It is a stiff curve. And so your question is, I didn't fully get it.
No worries. Like the point that it is more so complex, right?
Right.
If it's a graph or not, do you think that's why it's so powerful as well? Because it is built and modeled like that?
No. I don't think that the power of Kubernetes comes from its complexity. I think it comes from years of understanding how things should be done from a problem perspective, a challenge and a solution perspective, like those feedback loops, right? They come from more from robotics than software engineering, I think. software engineering, but some problems are solved in Kubernetes with an approach which is unique, and then they bring in other other concept, and all these concepts together, they form this distributed and complex system.
Power.
And the power of Kubernetes, I think, it's the sum of all these approaches and these methods to solve problems in an intelligent way. The complexity, I think, is a byproduct of it. So it's not necessarily the design need. Well, it's a design need, but the complexity is a byproduct of that need.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that might be a fallacy, that if you think that something is complex, therefore it is powerful. I feel like it's more so that keeping things simple and simplistic, that's where the power lies.
Right.
But you just add on top of that, and then the byproduct, as you mentioned, could be complexity.
True. True. Yeah. I think it's a good way of seeing it. And nevertheless, it's absolutely true. The learning curve in Kubernetes is quite steep.
Yeah.
And there are things that run on top of Kubernetes,
which have
even a steeper learning curve. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. How was that for you then, picking it up for the first time? Because you're not a software engineer by background.
No, absolutely not. No.
Yeah. What'd you do before?
I worked before working on Kubernetes, and where I am now, I used to work at Hitachi Vantara.
Yeah.
And I was specifically working on conversion, hyper-converged systems with VMware and Microsoft Hyper-V, or also some SAP HANA. So from there to Kubernetes, well, let's say that I might still feel I am living the imposter syndrome.
Everyone is feeling that.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I love it, and I'm freaked out.
Yeah.
But it was steep. It was steep. I got interested in Kubernetes, of course, like everybody else, as something absolutely cool. And it made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
We need an orchestration for containers. And what we had with Mesosphere wasn't really doing it. Hmm. But it was very hard. At the beginning, it was very hard. I was trying to understand what the heck am I doing.
Was it just you, or were you with the team?
No,
kind of picking
it was,
that up.
Picking that up on my own time.
Okay.
I was just learning it. And then I said, well, this is what I want to do. So I applied for a few positions, and then eventually I got at SUSE, which had just acquired Rancher.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that they were acquiring Rancher, but so my approach in Kubernetes was through first vanilla, the hard way, like everybody else.
Yeah.
And then I started looking into Rancher and the Rancher Kubernetes engines, and I was like, okay, that's cool. Let's keep going. And I got the job at SUSE, and then I think after a week actually, while I was waiting for my first day, it was announced that SUSE acquired Rancher. And I was
that's funny.
Whoa.
Good stuff.
I'm in the right spot.
It's funny how those kind of combinations of events sometimes happen.
Right. Yeah. You just sit in the middle and it's like, whoa, I'm just going to let that happen.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But you didn't study any software engineering related topics, no?
Not as a major, not as a requirement. Well, it was more of a need.
Yeah.
I studied physics.
Yeah.
Not completed. Without dating myself, when I studied physics in Italy, you needed 5 years to get any paper worth showing. But nowadays it's 3 years. Then you do, for your bachelor, then you know.
Yeah, they've shortened it.
Right, they shortened it. I did my 3 years, which meant absolutely nothing. That's where I started my software engineering. Software engineering. My programming, I wouldn't call it software engineering.
Yeah.
Was with Fortran.
Okay.
So I did some C and moved on. Just when I left the university, I just moved on for fun with some programming.
Yeah.
My Perl, my Pascal, and you know, don't let me mention them all.
No, no, no. That's okay. Did your background in physics, do you think it's still helping you? Because I always wonder. Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
Like in some weird way, what we're doing now or the field that you're in the technology field, I feel like you can always leverage kind of your past experience.
Yeah, absolutely. It's if I would travel back in time,
yeah,
and choose something else, it would be exactly the same thing.
That's awesome.
It is what I would maybe the only thing that I would do is complete.
Come on, man, it's not that bad.
But no, absolutely, it was the best choice, and I don't think I also today is affecting some decisions that I take.
Yeah,
at least in my work.
Do you have an example of that? Like the knowledge of physics, how it's helping you now as well?
Yeah. Yes, I do. When I can be very too specific.
Okay.
But
that's okay.
For me, in example, the entropy and enthalpy, like energy of a system.
Yeah.
The chaos, what some people like to call chaos. And it's always applicable to a complex or a coordinated or semi-coordinated system.
Yeah.
And the more the more problems you see, the more unclean is an outcome.
Yeah.
Though you have an outcome, right? You have an outcome and it's what you wanted. The more it's kind of hard to explain how I see it, but
no worries.
But the more unclean that outcome is, even though it is what you want, the most likely that system that generated the outcome is not all right. It's not going to be a stable system in the future or a stable solution for the future. So we should go back and redraw and look further at what are the improvement that can be made.
Yeah.
So that is a little bit my view, my not my view, but my remembrance of my physics studies. Right.
Interesting.
When you look for an energetic balance of an ecosystem, of a system.
Yeah, I can imagine that that's helpful now because, right? Sometimes the internals of a system or what is actually happening can be. Right, due to time, due to many hands having touched different things and different components, maybe some standardization hadn't happened or some conventions weren't in place yet, or things just shifted and through learning you've improved,
right.
It can be really hard figuring out what the internals is.
Yeah.
So then you're like, okay, this is the input and this is the output, right? You kind of treat it as a black box.
Yeah.
And then if you figure out that your output is not necessarily what you wanted or it's like deviating slightly, then something internally is still incorrect, right?
Right, incorrect.
Yeah.
And you do see a shift in energy as well.
Yeah.
You do an increase in energy. This somehow the system is trying to balance itself. Kind of very spiritual way of saying it, but the system is trying to balance itself. So you see an increase in energy. You see, if you're looking at logs, you see way more log than you should be seeing. A lot of stuff going on. The system is imbalanced. So therefore, there is some work that needs to be done.
Yeah, very interesting. So, yeah. Where did kind of this love or this passion for systems and even distributed systems, where did that originate from?
At university.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, as well. We were working on a system, a very early system for HPC, high performance computing. It was a cluster 486DX systems.
Yeah. That says nothing to me. sorry about that.
That's age. So there was the Pentium?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's after.
Okay, gotcha.
So, anyway, this white box computer, right? I mean, this 486 is just x86 system.
Okay.
And that's 486, that's where x86 take the names from.
Okay.
Just to let you know. Maybe you look it up.
I will, don't worry.
But we were putting them together to get, so we were using a Beowulf type of architecture to build a high performance cluster. So basically message passing interface, processes, you know, being shared across multiple CPUs. And I found it very, intriguing and interesting. And I kept working on it with the others. And I did develop some kernel patches for extending the memory use across CPUs.
Yeah.
So stacking the memory, literally. That was the starting point of distributed system. Then I left university. I did a few other things in the meanwhile, not very meaningful.
They're all meaningful.
Yeah,
in some way.
You're right. You're right. They are. And then I was interested in the OpenMosix project at the time. It was by Moshe Bar.
Yeah.
He created this kernel patch for Linux for a single system image cluster. So I worked on the Beowulf clusters, and that one was an SSI. So to explain as easy as I can, the application would see the system as a multi-CPU
like landscape
operating system, right? So if you had threads, they wouldn't migrate to other CPUs. However, if you had processes, they would. Mm. I got something to do. I can do just for fun.
For fun
and to try out, I can create the memory stack sharing for SSI. And there was a group of ladies from India.
Yeah.
Brilliant group of girls. They created this patch for the memory sharing, and it was absolutely the next level. I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And yeah, then Moshe Bar, he moved to Xen, I think, afterwards, and the project got stopped. No, I think there were no maintainers left for it, and I didn't have it to maintain it myself. So I said, well, I was a spectator, just gonna, you know.
Yeah.
Just, I'm not going to interested anymore. I was interested, but I'm not interested in maintaining, so I'm not proposing myself for it. But
yeah, that's a humongous task, no?
It is. Yeah. I feel it is. Yeah.
I feel respect
for any maintainers out there.
yeah, for sure. Like it's so interesting to me that open source is what a lot of software fundamentally is built upon, right?
Right.
But that also has a maintenance component to it. Can be a team. Can also sometimes be one person, which is ridiculous, right? Yeah. Sometimes this thing that you built can have an outreach that you wouldn't imagine. And then you have tens of thousands of people, thousands, maybe 100,000 people, telling you what they think of this thing that you've built, right? No, you should go right or left or straight. And it's all different anyways. And there's all trade-offs because that's what software is.
It is. And I find very concerning that there are so many maintainers that are doing, as you say, a humongous job beside their daily job.
Yeah.
And there is no actual support, meaning, you know, funding or some, you know, some, I don't know, on GitHub, some donations that you can do. Yeah. There are many that receive any donation, and they struggle to keep the lights on their project and at home. Because many have a second, have an actually daily job, but many others, that is their source of income, so which is their productivity and their open source efforts.
Yeah. So for those people that have two jobs, like the open source is, I see that as a job as well, and like a day to day for income.
Right.
They probably have built this thing, and there's such a huge sunken cost in general that they don't want to let go, right? Even if they wish they would let go, they can't do that to themselves or to a community, because now you're kind of responsible to the people that are using it as well.
Yeah.
Which is this very, very weird dichotomy that I don't think you have in any other field, where something is open, people can use it, then you are responsible. And if you let go of that, you either disappoint people or things just break,
which is also
an option.
Yeah, I think it's a construct only of open source.
Yeah.
It's... Which is hard. Alex Ellis as well. I read few notes of him, few points where he says how hard it is to work on these things without support. So we should always think. I think we can spare that pizza money for you know, for a good project.
Exactly.
It's not going to change our life, we do or we don't, but it can change the life of somebody else.
Exactly. That is the power of kind of collectiveness in that aspect, exactly. Right? Yeah. If that collectiveness then supports one entity, then all of a sudden that's a huge difference.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And I don't see, right now, I don't see that changing, right? It's the power of open source. Everyone can use it. You can build something. All of a sudden people love it. They use it. It needs to be somewhat established, but still takes some time.
It does. It does. But you also have to you have to look at where we're coming from in open source, where we were 30 years ago, where we were 20 years ago, where we were 10 years ago,
yeah,
where we are now, right? I mean, before it was absolutely that geek in that dark corner, building something, pushing it on internet somewhere,
yeah,
with a modem, and you hope you get some interest, and that's it.
Yeah,
but you don't hope to get money; you're hoping to get interest.
Yeah,
and then now there are people building something which is massive. They put it out there, looking for interest and hoping also to build a business around it.
Yeah.
So you think about the product and you think about the business model around it. Whereas before, you think about that cool thing.
And the solution.
It's like, you know, let me see if somebody else wants to play with it as well. So that's how it was.
Yeah. That business model, open core is what I've been told. That to me is fascinating, right? And
right.
It can come from both ways, that you already have kind of an open source tool, and you make it easier for people to use it, make it easier to integrate in organizations. You take away some of the operational maintenance part of it. You run it basically for someone else to use it.
Right.
I think that's very interesting. Or the other way around, where you internally, you build a product and then you open source part of that product that you've already built.
Right. I also find it fascinating. I also find it quite dangerous.
Mm.
Those paywalls that sometimes company build, and it's kind of using the open source community sometimes, and it, which is not bad, but you might abuse of the concept. So like, yeah, I am releasing this piece of code. I'm releasing this product. But to take it to the enterprise level, to take it to actually use it in your company securely and safely, you gotta need to pay. And for some startups, that's a no-go.
It's
like, it's what they can do. So I do instead like the SaaS model where you release the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, use it on-prem, on cloud, however you want it. But if you are a startup, you can also think about using the SaaS version, and you know, you build your product around ours. It's fine, and then you can also use the SaaS version because you don't have money to build rack and rack of servers, and you know. So I prefer that model instead of the paywall of the enterprise features.
Yeah, to me, I don't see the paywall initiative having much longevity anymore. Like, that feels kind of dated,
right?
Because if I like engineering. Has a lot of decision-making power, more so nowadays than how it used to be, right?
Yeah.
In a team, you can already decide kind of, especially if you're in a startup, what you're going to do, what tools you're going to leverage. And exactly as you mentioned, if our focus is this product, then I don't want to maintain some server with some piece of software just because it's free, right? If you can afford it, you get it as a SaaS variant.
Yeah.
And then you use it and you still focus on what you need to focus on.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I think because the paywall, like, already is a hurdle for people to adopt or to even figure things out, I feel like that doesn't have longevity anymore.
It doesn't. A great example is Backstage, right? Mm. I mean, Backstage is a fantastic product. It's needed. We need to enable developers to get detached from the platform that they are deploying to.
Yeah.
And Backstage makes a lot of sense, and things like Backstage make a lot of sense. But when you start, it's donated. I hate the word donated, but it's handed over to the CNCF.
Yeah.
But if you really want to use it in an organization, you're going to need RBAC. And RBAC, you've got to pay.
You got to pay.
To have it. And you got to pay for that plugin. And I find it a model which does not have, does not take into account this, those little companies that are trying to make it.
Yeah. So that's hard.
Which are a lot, and that's a lot of business, to be honest.
Yeah. So no, that's hard. Yeah. I think it has a lot to do with trust as well. Like there's this thing called trust equation, and I don't recall it correctly to kind of define what it means now, but maybe from some people look it up. But in any case, like the way you act or your honesty and your integrity, that all shines through, right? Shines through in what you do as a person, shines through in what you stand for as a company as well.
I believe that. Yeah.
And things like that will diminish from that trust equation. And some people will still accept that, that level of trust that they have. And some people won't, and they won't use those services anymore.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I think that that holds true for people as well as organizations, which is interesting because then the organization is kind of an artifact of how you operate as a person as well.
Yes.
Or like as a collective.
Yes. Whatever, whatever you build, it's whatever you are, right? That is sometimes true. We're not going to mention companies, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But when you kind of came into this field, would you imagine being so involved in either communities or with people in so far, or did you have kind of a different perspective? Because I always think, for me, I thought, okay, I'm going to be a software engineer, right? I'm going to work with software. It's going to be more so isolated. I'm going to create this piece of artifact, kind of reflecting sometimes how I think and stuff. And that's then going to combine into this puzzle piece that is going to be our picture of reality or the picture of the thing we're building. And I'm going to do that with other people, but I'm still going to be responsible for like my little puzzle pieces. Which holds true in some aspects, but completely not in other aspects either.
True. No, I didn't imagine. When I started with IT, of course, like everybody else, I think, it's your thing.
Yeah.
It's your time. You are interested. You go through with your what you're learning, what you're doing. When I started getting more and more interested into open source, which of course started with Linux, I'm not going to tell you the kernel version because otherwise I'm really going to tell you how old I am.
That's okay.
You're in your room, right? And you're like, okay, this is cool. This is how it works. And you go with Linux from scratch and you start compiling your own kernel and all of a sudden you feel untouchable,
yeah.
But you get out and nobody absolutely care
about. But you're on a high though.
Yeah, but you are absolutely off. You know, in the clouds. You get that to today is exactly the opposite.
Mm.
Is everybody's interested in what you're doing? Everybody has a sort of not knowledge but awareness of this open source movement, of this community, of this being part of something. There are so many conferences, like take KubeCon, take QCon, take so many DevOps days, so many conferences going on, and you see like-minded people that are not those geeks sitting in a room, in a dark room, and doing their own thing that nobody understands, but it's more of very open, very social animals.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, we realize that we're not that asocial a person, but we are very social. We want to show, we want to tell, we want to hear. I find it fantastic. That I'm busy with the community. I'm trying to build something. I'm trying to be part of it. And I couldn't imagine not being anymore. So it is amazing. Yeah.
I'm really happy that there are those spaces where people that are like-minded and have a shared passion can come together, right?
Right.
Because that is usually the only part of the equation you need for knowledge sharing to happen. People that come to those events have a genuine sense of curiosity. So you have really interesting discussions.
Yeah.
And that's the real community aspect of things.
It is.
It is so different from how it used to be.
It is. Before the get together place was an IRC channel.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it had, you begin building your own image of how somebody is and not necessarily of a person image, you know, you give a mental shape to that, nom de plume or acronym or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Nickname.
Yeah.
But that's it. And you build a friendship and you build, you build this, this way of communicating with that person. And that is this, you do exactly the same things in real life, right?
Yeah.
But nowadays you do it really in real life. Now you have a place to meet.
Yeah.
You have DevRels that meet constantly somewhere in the world at conferences, and they get in touch. It's like, are you going to that conference? No, I'm going to that one. And it's beautiful. It's it wasn't like that.
No.
It wasn't like that.
No. And I think I love it. The only thing is I'm really bad at kind of that part of upholding connections and like maintaining a network. Like I talked to a lot of people just by virtue of doing the podcast. Mm-hmm. I got you on because Bart Farrell said, William's awesome. Talk to William.
Bart right? is awesome.
But but Bart reached out to me and I feel like I'm really bad at kind of maintaining connections or a network. Are you like that as well? Or do you kind of have your stride in that?
I am not good at it.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm bad. But I'm not good at it. I see some people like Bart, an example, like Alessandro Vozza or Andrea Giardini, the people that I am lately constantly texting with and organizing something. I see that they have a method in it. They have their own way of doing and they're good at it. You can tell they're good at it.
Yeah.
Me, I'm not bad. I'm not an obstacle to them, which is a good thing.
Sounds like good.
But I'm not as invested as they are.
Yeah.
I could be more, but my job is also, I'm making an excuse now, and my job is also preventing me from being more invested than I am.
Yeah.
So I'm not a dev rel, which I need to keep those communications going. I'm not a content creator. I'm a consultant, so I need to make those billable hours.
I can make that same excuse. That's very funny.
Good.
It's like, I want to, but maybe there's like the incentive is not there. I don't know why. It's just, it's time and effort.
Yeah, it is time and effort. And it's also what you like, right? I mean,
yeah.
I do love the social part. I love it.
Me too.
And I couldn't be without it. But sometimes I love more the technical part.
Mm. pulls you back.
Yeah, it pulls me back. It says, this is who you are.
Yeah.
Just do your thing.
That's also fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's get back to that keyboard. and it's fine. It is why I am in this community, today now. It is because I love that technical part.
Yeah.
It is because I want to get out and say, hey, check out what I just did, or check out what I just learned, or check out what that guy does. And maybe that's why I'm not good at keeping contacts, because I still want to keep my, maybe that guy that in the dark room coding or compiling
still
kernel,
inside you.
He's still there.
That's okay.
He's still claiming space.
I like that a lot because it's a spectrum, right? And you kind of fit somewhere on that spectrum. And I don't think there's a right or wrong. There's
no
golden ticket. There's no, this is what you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
You're just there. And you're like, oh, I'm a little bit more left. I'm a little bit more right. It doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't.
Right?
Absolutely.
And you find your stride in whatever you do and you enjoy the sides as well, which is completely fine.
Yes. Yes.
I think that's really
true.
Cool.
I'm absolutely agreeing with this.
Cool, man. I've really enjoyed this talk so far.
Likewise.
It was a lot of fun having you on. Is there still anything you want to share with regards to our audience?
I like our audience. I don't know. I would love to say just hook up with me. Just try to find me. Let's have a chat or whatever. But that's not what I'm gonna say. But though I just said it,
I'll say that for you. Don't worry about that. I think I should prepare people more because I always throw this curveball at the end.
Yeah.
Sometimes I don't prepare people for it.
No, don't prepare them. Don't prepare them. Just cut this piece and just tell them.
There's no cutting though. This is gonna make it
good. So just ask them at the end the question. That they have to come up with.
That's also good. Some people take it and roll with it, and some people are like, no, I really liked it. Which is also fine.
Yeah, that's it. It's fine.
Good stuff. Then I'm gonna round it off here, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Check out William Rizzo. Is that
Rizzo,
the pronounce?
Yes.
Rizzo. William Rizzo. I'm going to put all his socials in the description below. Check him out. Let him know you came from our show. And with that being said, thank you for listening again. We'll see you on the next one.